Let's talk.
John Brown. Soho Days, Camden Nights, the chronicles of a failed indie rock star. It's 1996, if only. And Andy, also known as Horace, is stuck in a den admin job at a Soho picture library. He dreams of becoming an indie rock star over, but luckily he's found the next big thing. Now, when I get the press notes, I'm going to go, this is the Wizard of Oz bit where I go behind the curtain and go, look, when I get the press notes, you know, I go, yeah, fine, skip. And there's always some PR person called, I don't know, Jacinta or Tristan or something. And they go, this is good. And there's some ramble about how the client is this, that, and the other. This just made me stop, okay, because my next guest found the next big thing, because he was a gig promoter, a Norwegian three-piece band who sound like ABBA meets Nirvana. I'm sold at that. I'm sold at that introductions. Ladies and gentlemen, girls and boys and whatever. Soho Days, Camden Nights author, Andy McLeod joins me live on the line from some rooftop pad in Hollywood or something like that. Morning, Andy.
Yeah, that's where I am.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm in Hollywood. Yeah. I've got a pina colada in one hand and
yeah, exactly. Get me New York. Let's have lunch. Let's have lunch and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, yes, darlings.
Yes, darlings. Right then.
Lunch.
Now, Andy, just for those who haven't crossed your path before, I mean, I was sold at a three-piece who sounded like ABBA meets Nirvana.
So was I.
So let's get in the time machine. 30 years ago, and it's 1996, and it's all Britpop, and it was coming home apparently again. And so what are you doing at this point in your life? We'll go American. What are you doing at your point in this life, Andy?
Oh, my God. Well, I just turned 27. So I'd been in a band called the Pointy Birds. Might be one of the reasons we didn't
make
it.
Is that from The Jerk, the Pointy Birds?
The Man with Two Brains.
Pointy Birds. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, and
I thought it was the greatest band name of all time, yeah. The Pointy Birds. I had the name first, and then it was a case of, right, I've now got to find a band to fit the name. And we weren't very good, I have to say. We weren't very good, but our claim to fame was that we were managed by Ricky Gervais before he was famous. He worked at the London Yulu, and I was sort of working in a record shop. I had my band, the Pointy Birds, and he got in touch, and he was a gig promoter then.
Right.
And he liked our demo. And then we went on this journey with Ricky for about 6 months while he tried to make us famous. The irony was we were trying to get rid of him for someone more serious.
Yeah, because the thing is, I mean, Ricky Gervais's, you know, diplomatic skills. I mean, you don't have to look at those times he's hosted those American awards. I mean, he's a natural as a manager for opening those doors and making friends and really, you know, being able to put his scruples to one side and not insult anybody. Isn't he, Andy?
Yeah, well, I'm just still holding out hope he's going to see the light and come back and manage us. this is why I've written the books, to try and get him back, you know. I think I just dined out on the fact we were the band that didn't become rich and famous, but our manager did.
That's a thing. Here's the thing, because I mean, I was at Camden at the wrong point, at the wrong time. I was in Camden sort of late 80s, and it was all like, you know, it was a jazz cafe and electric ballroom and all that sort of stuff. Staying with a mate of mine who had a place on Inverness Street. So for those who don't know how Camden was culture centre of that, because it was a very exciting place to be.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think Madness, I think, kicked it off in the, you know, the late 70s, 80s, where they sort of were the Camden band. But I think the moment, and then a lot of those pubs, it's like a musical kingdom, and all the pubs, the Dublin Castle, Edinburgh Castle, they're like castles in a musical kingdom. And I think in the late 70s, 80s, some of them said, well, we'll get rid of the strippers and the Sunday roasts, and we'll put on live bands. And it kind of grew. And so there was this infrastructure there. And I think what I sort of talk about in the new book is when Kurt Cobain died in 94, that same week, Creation Records then released the debut single from Oasis. Mm. And Creation were based in Camden. Food Records, based in Camden, released Park Life by Blur. So there's this handing over. And that... that then kind of got, I think then it was just the Britpop explosion from then on.
And of course, at this point, Camden hasn't become, I mean, the lock is still the lock, and the market's still, yeah. You know, I remember being buying bootleg cassettes, that dates me.
Yeah, it's all grungy.
Yeah, all grungy, and it's not sanitised, it's not touristy. Dingwalls does not, I mean, I went to Dingwalls and went, hello, a couple of years ago, because it never used to look like that. And it was, it was a bit, you know, as most of London was at this point, a bit shabby, but at that same time, it was, if you like, genuine.
Yeah, I'd say the heyday was really from that sort of, the 90s, you got that sort of Britpop explosion. Then you got a second wave of the indie rock stuff coming in, all that, like the Libertines in the noughties.
Yeah.
And then the third wave would be Amy Winehouse. And I think that Kurt Cobain to Amy Winehouse is the heyday. And after she died, it almost felt like maybe that, the kind of, the gastro pubs moved in, the property dumpers. I mean, it's still got a buzz, I think, Camden. It's still, but it's definitely, I mean, it's like a Hollywood version of Camden now, you know. The big venues do really well. The sort of Cocos and Roundhouses. So they're very good for those sort of touring big bands at Camden now. And there's a still, the heyday, there would have been about six. When I first started promoting, there was basically three venues in Camden.
Yeah.
And then it went crazy. There was about 60 by, I think the Camden Crawl, there was about 60 venues, and then they've all closed since then.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, yeah.
When did you make that most sort of seismic of decisions and think, you know, I may not be the front man. The Pointy Birds may not be the next big thing, and move into the dark arts of promotion. Because, I mean, I've done concert promotion, I've done backline, and I always say that it's crisis management and chaos theory at all times. Yeah.
Well, I still haven't given up the dream. I mean, it's too late, is it? Yeah, I shall never play the Dane. No, I am still hopeful, you know.
Sorry, but ladies and gentlemen, if you don't get that reference, just turn your radios off now, okay? Because there's nothing more crushing in a young man's life when he realizes that he will never play the Dane. All right, Andy, keep going.
I got done the Pointy Birds. I did another band, Big Slice, and really everyone around me was going to make it, but not me. You know, the shop I worked in, Select Disc on Berwick Street, it had we were on the cover of the Oasis album,
What's
Story Morning, and even the shop became famous, you know. But bandmates went off. So I got offered to, did I want to do a gig at the Camden Falcon, like promoting it? And I really didn't, but I thought, okay, I'll try it as a one-off, and I loved it. And I kind of crossed the Rubicon from the creative to the commercial, you know. And I found I was probably a lot better at being a gig promoter than I was being a lead singer.
But the thing is, if you've been that side, you know what bad, and I'm not saying I only want white kittens and take the green M&Ms out of my rider, but you know what bands like, you know, they'd like a clean towel, some water now and again.
Yeah, definitely. And you can kind of relate to that. I could kind of really feel, you know, when you're in a band, you're just desperate. Will that A&R guy turn up? And I could sort of relate to that hope. And that I love that about those small venues. You know, it's that, it's like an empty, smelly room, but, you know, it can come to life and it can be quite magical. And we went on an amazing journey, really. I met with Tiny Two, the ABBA Nirvana band. We got a deal for them with Fierce Panda Records, and it kind of opened a door. And then I started promoting gigs with Simon from Fierce Panda, and we just did for about 25 years. We're doing it. So we stumbled across Coldplay in a back room, The Killers, Arctic Monkeys. We did all those sort of bands at the early stage, and then they kind of flew the coop.
Yeah.
But also we did hundreds of great bands that didn't go on, you know. So it's there's a kind of sadness to it, because you just see such talent, you know.
How did Fierce Panda come into your orbit then? You know, a masterstroke of, as I said, description, you know, ABBA crossed with Nirvana. I'm just trying to.
He got that. I sent it to him. And I also said it's like the wedding present meets the Sugar Cubes as a kind of more indie version.
Yeah.
But because Simon's label is called Fierce Panda, it's an adjective and an animal, a bit like the Pointy Birds.
Yes,
you know?
Indeed.
We hit it off. And, he was working at the NME at the time, so the label was a real stepping stone. If you did a single on Fierce Panda, you kind of went on, and usually he'd done Supergrass, all these kind of bands, and we just got on. We were both Tottenham fans. We both we had the same trainers. We both were in these Adidas trainers, and we just sort of clicked. And then he was putting out loads of records, and I was doing the gigs, and I just it was like fell into it, and it really worked, and we end up doing, yeah.
Because it's kind of, you know, they also, you know, life is cyclical and the whole thing, but if you think about it, because we went through that period of, like, 70s prod rock, dinosaurs, et cetera, and then we get, you know, roughly, we get the punk, and then we get new wave, and it's all everybody starting up yeah. labels, and same situation, you've got, you know, Kilburn and the High Rose and lots of stuff. And then we get the 80s, yeah, and we get through the 80s, and again, that's all Scott Aitken, Waterman, it's all A&R and the whole thing. Yeah, and then we get, you know, grunge, which leads into Britpop, which leads into a second, rebirth of indie. And suddenly, as you said, there are, you know, it's not, you know, having an A&R session at the Limelight or the Empire, for example, you know, or, you know, where you can meet Kylie and Jason. It is, like you said, you're trying not to get Pete Doherty vomiting over your shoes somewhere in a bathroom.
Yeah, the toilets are something else in those. I mean, they're known as toilet venues for a reason.
Exactly.
I love that toilet circuit. It's kind of, I realise, you know, we were always desperate to kind of go on and have a number one, and then I kind of slowly realized, God, these venues are really special and they've got to be protected, and there's nothing better than a small, seeing a band in a small gig is the best thing, you know, the whites of the singer's eyes, the smell of the armpit, the person next to you.
Yeah, sorry. So sorry about that. Yeah. Here's the thing, because people are like, oh, it's 30 years ago, and you know, we got rose tinted binoculars come back at that time. But you do really. This is the question, because you know that the band is good. They've done the hard yards. They're playing. They're tight. Yeah. The whole thing. Everybody's loving them, and yet you're seeing other bands who perhaps aren't up to the standard. And it is that great, you know, it is, it's like, well, you know, there's always footballers, there are always great footballers who could have been the best but never made it or weren't there when that scout was there. Was it a bit like that, you know, was it a bit like that feeling?
Yeah, definitely. I've got this theory, I think it's probably completely rubbish, but you've either got to be 10 out of 10 or 7 out of 10. I think if you're 8 or 9 out of 10, you're in trouble, because you're not maybe not quite the genius where you're going to, the cream will rise to the top, but the 7 out of 10 bands quite often do quite well, because they can dumb it down a bit to the common denominator. But then everyone's score is different. Like my 7 out of 10 might be someone else's 8 out of 10. But I think there is an objective score. You can kind of deep down, you know, I don't want to name any bands, though.
Yes.
But yeah, there's definitely some 7 out of 10s that went on, did very well. And I know a lot of, well, I think the 10 out of 10s are always going to make it, but they're very, very rare. Bruce Springsteen, for instance, he was always going to make it, you know. And I think there's also that desire. There's an irony, I think, with a lot of bands, and I had this probably, that you don't really want what you think you want. And there's a kind of deep down, there's a lot of self-sabotage, there's a lot of fear of failure, fear of success. And it only takes one member of a band to go, ooh, you get a little bit of taste of it, and they go, one of them will freak out.
Yeah.
I don't actually want this. And it's really hard, you know.
It's normally the drummer. It's not. I've found in my experience, it's the drummer.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the? And the other thing is, of course, you mentioned Springsteen, but it's, you have to get the zeitgeist, don't you? Because if you look at Springsteen in that, you know, when he, you know, in the mid 70s, and he brings that out, and it's all blue collar working, and you know, America's gone into a very sort of navel gazing sort of blue collar worker, you know, post Vietnam. So it's exactly the right time. And with Britpop, right, when all that takes off, like you mentioned, Supergrass, we've got Blur. You know, if you're up from up north, it's Oasis, because it's polarized like that. And those are the scene, you know, those are the, if you like, the flag waving ones. And so anybody who comes after who doesn't fall, because I mean, you could go through you know, a 30 years 96 playlist, and you'll see, I don't know, Republica or other, but you know, stuff like that that people have, you know, have kind of forgotten about. And I'm sure the same with Springsteen. But with your lot, Nirvana meets ABBA, they can't be pigeonholed, so they can't, you know, they won't get across to the mainstream so much. Andy,
it was really hard to in a way, part of the reason around the book, I was trying to figure out where the first book on my head was, where did we go wrong, and this what books were like, what is it that certain bands are doing right? And I don't really know if I know the answer, but I think ultimately you certain bands catch a wave. And I think with Tiny Two, when we got their album, the water was just a bit flat for them. They didn't do anything wrong. It was just, for whatever reason, they just wasn't their right time, you know. But they were great. They really were Nirvana meets ABBA.
So what was the did you, how difficult was it to get them, get them into a studio? I mean, presumably you didn't have to babysit them too much because you'd been there yourself.
Exactly, yeah. We just, and it kind of, we got them in the studio. They recorded an album called Things That I Discover. They were from Norway. There's the three, they're Ellen, Hilda and Isabel. And they just rocked any venue that would have them. But yeah, it was just great fun getting in the studio, hearing songs come to life.
You see, the thing is, you've got the wrong sort of Scandi, because you've got Bjork, Sugar Cubes, right, Iceland. Yes. You've got, I don't know, Cardigans doing their stuff as well. Everybody's going mad about Nina. Yeah, getting mad about Nina Peterson. You've got Norwegians. I mean, that was the problem, I think.
Yeah, well, their predecessor were Aha was the big one. There, yeah, you see, and they. But yeah, I think Scandinavia and the UK is quite similar. They're just very good at producing those kind of indie pop bands, aren't they?
Exactly. Yeah.
So it wasn't to be.
It wasn't to be. So what are they doing now, as I say? Where are they now? It's a bit early for that to kick in, Andy, by the way.
The book, because the book is, Ellen went off and did animation, and Hilda went into academia, and Isabel as well went in doing all sorts of interesting things, and so I got back in touch and said, hey, I've written this book, and because there's all lots of bands, it kind of covers a whole period of the late 90s, there's lots of other bands, but I'm going to centre it on the 3 years I managed you, and they're the kind of case study within the book, and they're absolutely thrilled about it. We got a little Bandcamp site up for them now, like, and so the albums, it was before digital streaming, so the album's never been heard, so we're getting it back out there, and so at last, 25 years later, people can hear it.
What was the spark that made you want to write this book? What was the thing that got you thinking, you know, I need to, because I mean, they're going to be, you know, I mean, we wait till we get to 20 years since Amy Winehouse's death. I mean, everybody going, me and Amy, and I remember, and you know, she fell over me in a Dublin castle. I mean, we're going to be, and it will all be like people write about the Summer of Love, or you know, 67, or the whole thing. You know. So how do you write this without being too sort of cloying, as it were?
Well, yeah, it's just, I love stories and I love songs, you know, and it's sort of when I stopped writing songs, I think and then I moved over to be a promoter. I always had a bit of a creative itch that I hadn't done. So I'd secretly started writing when no one was looking about the point of person. Because I was talking about, Ricky Gervais was our manager. Yeah. This, it kind of grew. And then I thought, I may as well just get it down. And then the book did really well. It came out. And then I thought, well, everyone's saying, oh, what's the next book? And it was like, well, if that first book was why it was how I failed to make it as a Britpop indie rock star. It's called Anoint My Head. This one can be like a companion. Where it's more telling the story from the other side of the fence. And that the first book is kind of pre-Britpop. This one is, there's this lovely era post-Britpop where the Enemy was going, it's the end of the guitar. It's the end of Britpop. It's going to be, no one's going to listen to guitars. But actually, at that point in the late 90s, you had Coldplay, Elbow and Muse doing the toilet circuit in Camden. Yeah. All became stadium bands.
And strangely enough, actually what it does, Mark, is the end of NME Melody Makers. They don't see the internet coming and what it's going to do to their media and the way that people...
Hits them more than... But But the guitar is such a beautiful invention. It's like the bicycle. And I think... it's never going to go away because it's such, I think the new generations are coming through. There's so many people that, you know, they're discovering bands all the time. And whether it's the older bands, it may be harder for new bands to come through, but I think guitar music will just keep going because a guitar has 6 chords and you can write a million different songs from that, 7 chords.
Well, no, I mean, famously, I think it was Francis Rossi. I mean, not one of the indie favourites from, you know, from Status Quo. And he famous, when they got their Brit Award, he said 25 years and 3 chords.
Exactly, yeah, that's all you need. That's the magic of it. It's a bit like cooking, isn't it? Like, you get those, there's an amazing quote, like, French cuisine reveals the genius of the chef, but Italian cuisine reveals the genius of God, and the sense that they will use just 3 ingredients... and maybe a 4th ingredient and make something genius. And the same with, you know, G, C and F on a guitar will have written all the greatest songs you can think of.
And let's face it, if you can't, you know, you can't lug a piano to outside your the object of your affections, desires when you're 15 years old and say, "I've written this for you." You can't do it with a great. You can do it with a guitar. So therefore,
well, I've had a total renaissance since I turned 50. When the first book came out, I went and did a run at Edinburgh Fringe, and I did an adaptation of the book, and then I started playing Pointy Bird songs, and I didn't think I was going to do it, but someone said, "What?" But I was playing them for laughs this time,
right?
And I realized we should have done the comedy circuit really, and they went down so well because I was sort of, they were in the right context then. I go, "Can you?" I thought this was going to be number one, and obviously that you play it, and then and. Yeah, I've really rediscovered the joy of that sort of playing live, and yeah, fantastic.
Listen, any man who drops a Man with Two Brains and a Withnail reference in when we're talking about Camden, which is the most Withnail location as well.
Yeah, it is.
What are you hoping What are you hoping that people will learn from your journey, as the saying goes?
Oh, well, God. I mean, it's about the basic theme of the book is chasing the dream and what happens when reality gets in the way. That's what it's both stories are effectively about. But underneath that, it's maybe, you know, you get kind of the two questions like, who are you and what do you want to be? Is always the questions underneath that, or the protagonist looking at, well, what do I want from this? And so there's these kind of, it, you know, themes of identity and ambition throughout it. And it's like, what do you want? And do you really want that? It's a weird, the Spice Girls had that, you know, what do you want? Do you really, really want? And that question kind of goes throughout the books. And it's that period. And I was sort of thought tiny too. Yeah, it's the Spice Girls. It's girl power. But ultimately, it's really an ode to Camden and being young. And for me, it was right, but to remember these, like try and make them permanent.
Yeah.
These kind of memories when you're young. And they were good times. So I just wanted to get them down, really, ultimately.
The book is called Soho Days, Camden Nights. If you go onto our virtual bookstore, then click on it and it'll be winging its way to you, by the way. If people want to follow you and say nice things to you on that internet thing, where can they find you? I know you've got a website because I've been stalking you.
Yeah. I've got a website, but I'm such a Luddite. So I am on Instagram now. I'm as Andy McLeod, 1969. And Coldplay, very nice of them, they did a shout out about the book yesterday to their 29 million followers. So I'm following me now, I'm going, oh my God, because we, you know, they're in the book, they're one of the bands we came across in a pub, so there's a few chapters on the very lovely band that they are, and we got them in the studio, we did some gigs in the studio, and then they took off. So yeah, there's a story about them and that lots of different
people. You know that little thing about the Pied Piper and there's a little guy behind who gets left behind? I've got this vision of you guys as that, but come back, Chris!
I know, it's a bit like that. We are we're still on the circuit. I've actually formed it's going circular, that when Camden was sort of, after Amy died, the two invading forces were gastropubs and tribute bands. And I was like, nightmare, and I'm now in a tribute band.
Yeah, well, the funking, if you ever caught the funking bar, Stewards. Right then, almost out of time. Yeah. The book is called Soho Days, Camden Nights by Andy McLeod. Andy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Bye.